It runs in the family. They're some great horsemen right there. I mean, they and Trevor kind of has the same thing. You know, he worked for different types of people and evolved his own style too. And I think that's where our generation, we're very fortunate because those guys kind of paved the way. And now we're just kind of getting the, you know, feed off of what they did because now we get to evolve these styles where they were just trying to get these things broke, trying to teach them to do the maneuvers. And we're fortunate enough to be able to pick from everybody. So I think our road's a little bit easier than what they had to do.
You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to The Ride, a podcast brought to you by Horse and Rider Magazine, hosted by Nicole Cherico and Emily Carey. This episode of The Ride is brought to you by East of Wall. East of Wall, a new film directed by Kate Beecroft that is a portrait of female cowgirls in the New West, about a rebellious rancher who must cope with her family, losing her ranch, and providing for a group of wayward teens. Only in theaters August 15th. Once again, we'd like to thank East of West for sponsoring this episode of The Ride. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Ride. This is your co-host, Nicole Cherico. I am here with Emily Carey and our guest of today, Matt Palmer of Palmer Performance Horses. Matt is a recently million-dollar NRHA rider and has been in some of the major events all around the country. You've probably seen him on The Last Cowboy. He was part of the Run for a Million. Thank you, Matt, for coming while you are at a horse show to talk to us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
So we have a broad audience, some who might not be familiar with the NRHA industry. So for those who might not be familiar with who you are, can you kind of explain to our listeners your background and how you and your whole family got involved in the horses?
Yeah, you know, I was kind of born into it. Not at the highest level, you would say, but I was born into the horses. You know, my parents met through horses. When I first, you know, started showing, the first time I ever showed was at a big horse show. A lot of people know it's the Devon Horse Show. It was probably the last time I wore English breeches too. I was one and I was in the lead line class. You know, so I kind of grew up as a kid going around. My mom in Pennsylvania here, it's kind of a big area for English, Western, all that. And she did the pleasure horses. And my dad did the reiners, and I would just travel around as a little kid, farm to farm, and she would give lessons. And in that point, you know, I was probably 4, 5, 6 in there. We had a little 5-stall barn, you know, with a little ring in the backyard, and, you know, just the passion behind the horses. My mom was great at teaching. My dad was a construction worker. He owned his own roofing business. So, you know, the horses were always kind of there, not at the category that we do it at now. But that's kind of how I started into the horses, you know, just kind of traveling with mom, going and giving lessons and doing those types of things. So, you know, that was the very beginning of it.
So with that, did you grow up showing some of the more all around stuff? Were you always involved in the reining? Like how did you end up in the reining show pen?
So funny story. So, you know, when I was a kid, I started doing walk jog probably like 4 or 5 at the Congress. My mom was really big in the train of pleasure horses and the hunt seat under saddle, that type of thing. And my dad did the reining. So, you know, fast forward a little bit, I think I was 7 and I went, my dad had a horse named Totally Greyhound. Rocky Dare rode it, showed it. And dad was at work and I pulled the horse out of the stall at the barn. At this point, we just moved to our farm that we're at now. It was a little 10-stall barn with an outside ring. And I snuck up there. Mom was in the house. And I got TG, put him on the – I had this red tack trunk because I wasn't allowed to ride if I didn't saddle the horse. So I took TG, put him by the red tack trunk, threw my saddle up there, put my splint boots on, put the bit in his mouth, climbed up on the red tack trunk and went out in the ring. I went. And I started riding him and I'm running circles out there and I'm turning. My mom comes running out of the house. What are you doing? Your father is going to kill you. You know, so I never really rode a reiner much, but I always watched my dad. You know, you're a kid, you look up to your dad and he's riding the reiners. So anyway, fast forward that evening, my dad comes home. My mom's like, listen, guy, I don't want you to freak out, but I want you to watch this. And he's like, what? So I come out on TG's like, and he's freaking out. Joan, what are you doing? Why are you letting this boy on my horse? I worked through the, so anyway, I ride TG and my dad watches me ride. And, you know, he was pretty impressed. He was pretty impressed that I snuck out and got the horse by myself and that I had that passion to want to do the reining. So, fast forward a month later, the Carolina Classic came around and, I was seven. And I took Totally Greyhound in the 13 under, and I ended up getting lucky enough to win the class. And that's kind of how my passion started, you know, for the reining. And, you know, I've never kind of looked back since. But that was the funny story of how it all really started. And a lot of people that are in an NRHA, been around a long time, kind of remember that it was pretty unique and pretty fun situation.
That's so fun. Like, so would you say that that was kind of the aha moment you had that made you realize that you wanted to train horses for a living? Like, when did you decide that you wanted to become a reining professional?
You know, I was really lucky that my parents were both involved in the horses. You know, we didn't have a lot of money, you know what I mean? My father was a roofer and, you know, he did window siding. My mom was the horse trainer and, you know, they were wonderful. You know, I mean, they gave me what they could give me and we bought horses. And so, you know, when I was probably about 15, I wanted to get my first car, of course, you know, and my dad said, well, you got to work for it. So, you know, I went and bought this horse out of a sale off of Francois Goudier. It was a Bogey Splashy Jack. And, you know, I got my dad to put up some of the money. I put up some of the money and, ended up selling that horse, got my first car that was a Jeep. And, you know, that was the first time I really ever trained one from the beginning. And I really enjoyed it, you know, and then of course the reward at the end, you know, getting paid to be able to buy my first car. I'm like, wow, this could be something that I really want to do. But, you know, then, high school happened, you know, and I was lucky enough in 13 under, I won the world title on a horse named Chrome Plated Barry. Then I won the world title in 14-18 on a horse called Hollywood Lolita. And around that time, you know, probably about 16 when I won that one, I kind of thought about being a horse trainer, but then I was so involved in the playing baseball and sports in high school. And, you know, I was getting different colleges approaching me for scholarships and things. And, you know, my parents were big on an education. So, you know, I wanted to be a horse trainer, but if I was good enough to go play ball, they were kind of pushing me that way too. So, you know, I would probably say it was about, that time when I was 16 that I knew I wanted to be a horse trainer, but I also, you know, wanted to listen to the advice of my parents about going to college too. So at that point, I probably wasn't 100% sure I was going to be a horse trainer.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because you obviously grew up competing horses that were obviously a big part of your whole family, but then you also had this side of baseball and you did end up going to college for baseball, correct?
Yeah. I got a scholarship to play baseball. And, you know, there was a chance there that thought I was going to get drafted, you know, weren't sure if it was going to happen or not. Ended up my freshman year, ended up sliding in second base, tore my rotator cuff. And I was 18 at that time. And I ended up getting hurt and I got hurt pretty bad. That's when I, you know, I sat there and I thought about the rehab and, you know, I was and where I wanted to go in life. And I came home and every time I was sitting in my college dorm, I was reading the Reiner magazine. You know, that was the thing. I was reading the Reiner magazine. I was playing ball. I was reading the Reiner magazine. And I said to my parents, I said, you know, I think I want to take a semester off and I want to go intern with Tom McCutcheon. And Tom and Mandy were very willing to take me in. You know, I kind of knew him my whole life growing up. I've known Mandy my whole life and Tom. And at that point, Gunny was there, Gunny Matheson. He was, you know, just starting out working for Tom. So I went there and I lived with Gunny and it was a really good time in my life because it kind of showed me if I wanted to be a horse trainer, because at that time, Tom was pretty much one of the elite in the business and, you know, he had some of the best horses in the country. So it kind of motivated me to see somebody that was at that level. And maybe if I thought I could get to that level, that was kind of a real eye opener. And I was about 18 then that really pushed me to want to go be a horse trainer.
So with having, you know, we talk about like baseball and stuff and there's a lot of mental, you know, athletic kind of stuff that goes on in sports psychology, and how were you able to take your experience in the baseball, you know, area of your life and apply it to becoming a professional and competing at that level in the reigning? I'm sure there's a little bit of mental, you know, game that you can probably apply to both.
Oh man, I definitely agree with that. You know, playing ball, you know, you go to college, and when you go to college, you're the best of your high school team, and you get there, but then you're around the best of every one player of their high school team. So now, you know, you're just average when you get there because everybody is on that plateau. And for mentally, when I first went to college, that was really hard for me because, you know, I remember getting there and I just thought I was the fastest guy there. And, you know, I thought I would have, you know, no problem playing center field. And I get to college and, you know, next thing you know, this guy comes in the center field with me and he's standing next to me and he's the other center fielder and he's 6'5", all muscle. I mean, looks like somebody carved him out of a Greek God magazine. And here, me, I'm 18, scrawny, a little wet noodle, you know, and I'm thinking like, how's this kid 18? He looks like he's like 35. You know, I mean, there's always so many, it just blew my mind that there's always somebody better than you out there. So you have to work just as hard. And then, you know, in baseball, you can go and be 4-for-4 and have the best game. And then the next day you wake up and you go 0-for-4. And there's that mental where, you know, everything's going so right. And then all of a sudden everything goes so wrong. And that happens in horse training a lot. And I think those things kind of came together and have helped me for some of the things that have happened in my career that have been setbacks that have kept me kind of afloat. So, you know, playing those sports, doing what I did, it did take away because, you know, in my early, you know, after I got done at Tom's, I came home, I went to college again, fast forward a little bit. When I was probably, I didn't really take training reining horses serious till about 2010. You know, I was kind of working in my dad's business. I was half part-time training reining horses. I was playing 100 baseball games a year. You know, I wasn't all in. And about 2010, I got a horse named Whale of a Wiz, and my dad said, either you're going to waste all this talent that God gave you on a horse, or you're going to do something with it, and you need to pick one. And I was kind of a stubborn, hot-headed kid a little bit, and it took me to realize, like, at that point, I was about 27, and he said, you're going to do something with your life in the horse world, or you're not. And he's like, you need to pick and choose what you're going to do. And at that moment, I got that horse. And then I, from that moment on, I was all in. And I think I don't regret that. I think I'd be a lot further in my career, maybe be blessed enough to be a $2 million rider because I didn't take it very seriously. But I'm blessed where I'm at now because that journey has put me here. And there can be a lot of setbacks in this business. So I think it's made me stronger along the way.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned that you worked and learned from the McCutcheons. So did you have any other mentors along the way? And what was like special about their programs that stood out to you? And, you know, how has it helped you create your own training philosophy?
You know, I was lucky enough when I was a kid, I got to ride with Bill Horn. Bill Horn used to help me. Bob Anthony helped me. Rocky Dare has been a big influence in my career. He's one of my father's best friends, and he's a legend all in his own right. And Rocky's such a great showman. And then, you know, I also was fortunate enough and have been family friends with us was Craig and Ginger Smirsall. And Craig, he's such a horseman on getting them broke. So, you know, you take the style of Rocky being such a great showman and how to prepare to go show. And then I took that style of Craig where he was so good at getting these things so broke. And you mix those together. And then Mike McIntyre has been a big influence. You know, he was a really good family friend. And Mike, total opposite kind of style of Craig, where everything's a little bit more different in how the approach is, but they get to the end result. So, you know, here I am. I take Rocky, who's just one of the most elite showmen. You take Craig, who I just admire and how he can get a horse broke. And then you take Mike, who's kind of in between, a great showman, but also can get him broke. So you take those three totally different ways of getting things done. And they kind of that's kind of how I evolved my style and what I'm looking for in the horses. And I think taking those pieces from people that have all types of different programs and making something your own can build confidence with even in yourself because you start to kind of have your own program a little bit.
I'm a Midwest kid, and I remember watching Rocky Show at the Congress when I was growing up. And yeah, what a showman. It was really
He's
cool.
a legend in that. He's a legend. He's a legend. Yeah.
Yes. And then I had to grow up with Trevor Dare, which not fair. He used to whoop my butt in the horsemanship all the time.
Yeah, that runs in the family. They're some great horsemen right there. I mean, and Trevor kind of has the same thing. You know, he worked for different types of people and evolved his own style too. And I think that's where our generation, we're very fortunate because those guys kind of paved the way. And now we're just kind of getting the, you know, feed off of what they did, because now we get to evolve these styles where they were just trying to get these things broke, trying to teach them to do the maneuvers. And we're fortunate enough to be able to pick from everybody. So I think our road's a little bit easier than what they had to do.
But I think it's a different road too, because like now these horses are so specialized and they're bred so incredibly well that it's like, you know, what we were training 20 years ago has evolved into its own thing. And like the amount of talent that we're seeing, like some of these yearlings and 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds just come out the gate with, like, I think it's just totally changed the game in horse training.
Yes. I mean, it's so specialized now and what we do, and there's so many horse shows and how we have to get them so broke at a certain point, so that then when we're at a horse show and they're at home and the help's exercising them, that they're already that broke to get on. Like, you know, here I am in North Carolina talking to you guys. Next week, I got a horse show in New Jersey. I'm home 24 hours. And then I go home for 48 hours and I'm in a show in Garwood, Ohio. And in that span, I'm showing a whole different set of different horses. So we have to have them so broke. And when we do spend our time on them, it has to be so exact in what we're doing, because you don't have that time at home as much. And because there's so much purse money out there, there's so many opportunities to go show these things that, yeah, we have to have them so broke because, you know, we're on the road so much and you're showing a different string all the time. So it's definitely gotten a lot tougher, but we're in a really lucky spot in the reining world right now, because there's a lot of money to run for a lot of horse shows, and it's a great time to be in the sport, but you definitely have to be on your game right now to compete, because everybody's coming at all these different shows with loaded guns. So it's tough right now.
So kind of going off of that, you've talked about you're at a horse show this week, you're going to another one next week or the week after, and you're bringing a whole different set of horses. You're starting to get your 3-year-olds ready for the futurity season. You're, you know, there's still a lot of derby stuff to be done. How are you mentally and physically keeping yourself at like peak performance as you're going from one event to another, and essentially kind of changing how you ride and what you're doing at each show, depending on if you have a set of green horses, 3-year-olds, non-pros, your derby horses? How are you managing all of that?
You know, I listen to a lot of sports psychology books, believe it or not, because, you know, one minute you can be on a roll and the next minute you can go 2-3 shows where things aren't clicking and you start questioning yourself. So the biggest thing that I found, that the greatest athletes in any sport, you're talking football to tennis to baseball to basketball, whatever, the greatest athletes have a routine. And for myself, you know, this week we're in North Carolina, not a lot of opportunities for an Airbnb, but most shows we were just in Oklahoma City, we were in an Airbnb. When I go to the next 2 shows, Airbnbs. And when I do that, you know, I make sure, wake up in the morning, I have a routine. I try to get the same breakfast that I do at home. I have my electrolytes in the morning. If I have an opportunity to go to the gym for a half an hour, just more so to stretch my body out, do those things, because I bring 12 head mostly. The faraway shows, I always bring 12 head. Well, I'm riding all 12 head, not my assistants, not anybody else. So it's quite a lot. But the biggest thing that I found is if I can get myself into a routine, like when I practice at home, if I take that same routine on the road, I feel like it keeps me in a really good mental spot. And you're dealing with different weather conditions. You're dealing, you know, it's really hot and humid here. A lot of flies, a lot of things in North Carolina. It's a great place to show, but it's hot and humid. It's July in North Carolina. You know, you're in Oklahoma City, you have the rainstorms, the weather's changing, you know, all these things. And the horses change in that. And these horses are going on the road with me. The same horses that I'm showing here, I'm showing Derby horses and Futurity horses for the first time this year. Well, those horses were on the road with me in Oklahoma City 3 weeks ago for 2.5 weeks at the Derby. Well, the same thing. So when it comes to myself and to my horses, I try to keep a very exact routine on every single thing that I do, just like I'm at home. So when I travel, I kind of try to bring my home and my routines with me. And I feel like that keeps me a little bit more in a mental headspace. And I definitely think it keeps my horses more in a happy and mental headspace. But it's not easy, but you have to start to narrow it down what makes you comfortable. And I think that really helps a lot. You don't get homesick and tired of being on the road a little bit.
Yeah. And a couple of years ago, you had a little setback where you broke your leg and you couldn't train or compete for a while. Can you talk about what it was like coming back from that injury and what it took to come back mentally and physically?
Oh, man. That was last year. You know, I was at the qualifier. I think I might have been like, if I'm not mistaken, I think I was like 75,000 starting the year from my million or something like that. So, you know, I went into the year with a lot of big dreams. You know, I started off Florida. Florida went really good. And, you know, now here I am. I'm at the qualifier in Scottsdale and I had three really good horses. And of all the horses I'm on, you know, I just got done in Scottsdale there. I took a horse out there. They had a little 5,000 added open. I ended up winning the open on that. I'm feeling good. I'm riding Genghis, Frozen Shiny Gun. It's like on a Tuesday. And I get a rundown. Thing stops just like how he always does. I feel really good. And I stand there and I pat him. And it might sound weird, but I always pat this horse in a certain way because he's very he needs to trust you. And, you know, it took me a long time to get his trust. And once I got it, he became a really good show horse for me. And I gave him the certain pat that was kind of like a signal that we were done. And I stood there a minute. I'm like, you know what? I didn't do a left rollback. And I'm like, no, I'm going to be done. No, I'm going to do this left rollback. And I back up 3-4 steps and I open up my leg and this thing just shoots. And when he goes, his foot slips and they get tangled and he just fell right on top of me and broke my foot, snapped it in two. And I just remember laying there and just feeling the pain and then being in the hospital. And we go to the hospital and I'm thinking to myself, okay, they're just going to repair me and I'm going to get right back. I mean, that's the first thing I'm thinking. First, the pain was absolutely insane. And then I'm thinking, okay, and the next day they say, we can't do surgery here in Scottsdale. It's too advanced. You need to fly home. So I fly home, trying to get a surgeon, wait 2 weeks, go to the surgeon. He says, yeah, I think you can be back in 3 months. Well, in my mind, 3 months means I'm going to be back to riding, playing baseball, being normal. No, in 3 months, they're sticking me on a treadmill, putting me in the air so I can learn how to even walk again. And that hit me mentally tough because in my mind, I felt like, okay, the doctor says the bones are supposed to be healed. This is how it's supposed to be. And I'm supposed to get back to normal. And it wasn't that way. And I was not mentally prepared for that, watching all these good horses I had, all these things just ripped away that I built for so long. And I'm so lucky that I had wonderful customers and nobody left. But, you know, as I get back to even riding, I remember being at the Derby and I remember being in so much pain. I would go to the spa, Dave's spa, and stick my foot in there. Because, I mean, the pain was astronomical. So then you're not even riding as good because the pain's so bad. And that is when it hit me. That is when I needed to start thinking about mental health. And I did. And I put myself in a place where I started working out. I started looking at the bigger picture. And I started taking a step back a little bit. And but I was not prepared for that, you know. But I'm lucky that some of those sports things really helped me. But I'm going to tell you that was probably the biggest mental hurdle last year, but has now this year has started out really, really good for me. But at that moment, and I mean, to yesterday, my stomach dropped. Fernando was on a horse. He went to roll back and I don't know the severity of the injury, but I know that he broke his leg in some way, fashion. And, he's going, he was supposed to be at the American next week. And, it's unbelievable what we put ourselves at risk doing this. And, you know, I just pray for him because he's one of my really good buddies. But I know with that, and when he was laying there yesterday, you know, I mean, I was tearing up. I mean, I just got sick because I know what they tell you, and hopefully his will be a lot faster because it's the leg, you know, but I wasn't prepared mentally for when they said 3 months, but it wasn't 3 months. It was a whole year of me getting back, getting my leg strong again. So it's definitely a humbling sport.
Oh, absolutely. And it's always really interesting to me because a lot of the accidents that I hear about or witness, it's always something that you really aren't expecting, right? You were doing a rollback and like something that you do thousands of times a week. And especially on a horse like the one that you were on that has been a reliable, you know, partner for you. I talked to Bud Lyon. He had a horse that he was like just walking on in the warm-up pen, fell on his leg. And it's just like, it's crazy how fast it can happen. And I did not know that about Fernando. So I'm
hoping, just happened yesterday.
But man, that's tough. But not even just mentally, like, you know, sitting there going, oh my gosh, I'm going to be out for so long. But there has to be a little bit of a mental block too, that like when something like that happens, it's always kind of in the back of your head. And I've talked about this with other horse trainers, whether it was like a horse falling over when they were, you know, going down the fence on a cow, or just one ran, you know, I was talking to Devin Warren and he had one flip over out of nowhere. And it's just like, you know, it definitely is a mental struggle. And it's, you know, this sport is so much mental, just as much physical. And I talked to a lot of horse trainers now who are also saying they're working out for their mental health and their fitness, but it's just a great way to kind of keep them at the top of their game. So it's incredible that, you know, people are able to come back from those injuries and just keep fighting for what they want.
Yeah. I mean, chasing your dreams makes you, you know, and it's funny, like last year when I got back, I just didn't feel like myself, you know, like I was getting by, and, you know, I went to the Congress and I had one futurity horse. My other two got hurt because when I got back, they got hurt, and I got lucky enough. I got in the level four finals at the Congress, but I came home and I said, you know what? I have never missed a futurity in 20 some years, and I am not going to go to the NRHA futurity this year. I said, I need to sit back. I need to study my craft a little bit. I need to get myself stronger again, not be going trying to chase a horse show. And, you know, I'm going to show my 3-year-olds for the first time on Friday night here. But I got some really nice 3-year-olds. Like I said, the year has started out really well for me. And I think taking that step back, and sometimes it's hard for us as humans because we're always chasing, and especially horse trainers. You know, we want to go to the next show. We want to compete. We want to put ourselves out there for business reasons too. But, you know, I talked to all my customers and said, I'm going to take a step back. And I think when I took that step back and did not go to the futurity this past year was the best thing I ever did, because I went and I watched the go-arounds at night. My wife would copy them or whatever you want to, you know, and I would come back and I'd watch the go arounds. And then I'd watch when the top 75 made it. And I went back and I'd missed the level four finals 7 years in a row. The other year, I missed it 7 years in a row, for 7 years straight. And I would make at least two back to the semifinals. And I was always messing up in the semifinals. And I went back and I watched those semifinals. And then I went back and watched my semifinals runs compared to my first go runs. And I was just doing too much. And I think by taking that step back, I think it's made me a better horse trainer this year, because I don't get so frustrated and I take a deep breath a little bit more, because I got that opportunity not to be actually in the fire with the guys. I got to be outside of it. And I also think, you know, with my injury, it's kind of let me look at it from more of a, I'm not so stressed out. I got to win. I feel like I'm really blessed and fortunate to even be out there doing it. And I never looked at things that way. And I think by opening up those two perspectives, I think it's made me a better person. I think it's made me a better horse trainer. And I think it's made me a better family man too. And I think when these things do happen to you, as much as it feels like such a negative, I truly believe there's a positive somewhere down the line. And I think that has evolved into what's been going on for me now. So, take the negative and there'll be a positive at the end with it and run with it. And that's the best advice I can give to anybody that gets hurt or has setbacks in this, because I'm living it. So I know that I'm not going to say something that I'm not living, and I'm living it. So, and it's working.
Yeah, that's really great advice for anyone listening. And now, can we talk a little bit about the hashtag you guys use on social media? Hashtag why not us? Like, what was the inspiration behind that motto? Like, what does it mean to you? And how does that inspire you?
So we all know, I mean, it's kind of because of the last Cowboy. Everybody knows I'm a diehard Bengals fan. So Bengals have been bad for a long, long time, say 30 years. And in walked Joe Burrow. And he kind of said one day, why not us? And that just kind of stuck to me that, you know, he was so confident that he was going to come in somewhere that was a losing franchise for however long. And he ended up taking us to the Super Bowl. And I thought about that. And I was like, I'm from the East Coast. We all know it's a little bit harder when you got to travel, you know, and you got to find your ways. You know, when my friends, my best friends all live in Texas and Oklahoma through the business, it takes me 3 hours to get there. It takes me 18. So, you know, and I find a layover spot, and I had to find all these things to make me better because I didn't want to leave where I'm from because I love the East Coast. So, but it is harder. And, you know, I hear a lot of younger people that are youth kids or one, you know, future trainers. Oh, well, you can't do it from the East Coast. You got to live out Texas or Oklahoma. And, you know, I just kind of wanted to show them that, no, you can. Why not us? You know, you can do it. You can do it wherever you're from. And as long as you have a passion and you have a desire and you know how to work hard, there is no reason. Why not us? You know, and that's kind of why we came up with that slogan, you know, because I want to show people that you can do it. If you want to live in Colorado, or if you want to live in New Mexico, or if you want to live in Canada, you can do it. If you're a family person, you don't want to leave your family, but you have a dream to be a million-dollar rider, you can do it. You know, it's not, you just have to be in one spot. So that's kind of where we came up with it. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of been a pretty neat thing that a lot of people, you know, stop at the horse shows and talk about. So I didn't think it would stick as much as it has, but it has. So it's pretty cool.
It's really nice to hear though, because you're right. Like sometimes I don't compete at the level you do, but like I get FOMO because of my friends in Oklahoma and Texas and Arizona, and they have access to a million and five people 20 minutes away from their house, or they only have to drive mm-hmm. 2 hours to get to a horse show. And, but you know, then I get to look outside and I see these beautiful mountains that I'm next to. And, you yes. know, sometimes it's nice to hear a professional say like, you don't have to live in Oklahoma to do this. Like, and it's important. We need people all over the country that are participating yes. in these events. I mean, raining started in Ohio.
Yes. Yes. I mean, and Ohio is a huge, huge mecca of it. You know, I mean, it's probably, I would probably say Ohio is probably third. I think it's probably bigger than Arizona when it really comes down to trainer wise. I mean, when I go to a horse show in Ohio, I was at in Garwood where I crossed my million, and I was talking to Sammy Flaherty, and I'm like, my God, how many horse trainers do you guys have in Ohio? He's like, I bet you were the third biggest, you know, mecca in the reining world. And I started thinking about it. I mean, he started naming all the horse trainers that were there. I mean, that was more than all of Arizona. I mean, I was like, this is nuts. Like, but I didn't realize that, but it really is. And I do think that we need our horse trainers. I mean, it's like, we're here, we're on the East Coast. We have a really big show. A lot of my really good Texas friends are here because the money's big. I think you need it everywhere, because I think that, it's a beautiful thing how our sport is growing and people want access in different areas, and they want access to different horse shows. I have a lot of my customers fly in from all over, you know, and they're not from the East Coast, but they fly to the East Coast because they enjoy the horse shows. They enjoy the people. So I think that if you want to live somewhere and you want to push it, you just got to find the right remedies to do it. And I truly believe you can.
So going off your hashtag, going off of that inspirational kind of mindset, which, by the way, love, let's talk a little bit about The Last Cowboy. That I know personally, I have so many friends outside of the reining industry, and they all got hooked on the show and they loved you and they were cheering for you and they loved your boots that you had custom done for, I mean, it was, you just had such an inspirational story on it. What was it like kind of not only going for the run for a million, which is an insanely cool thing to be a part of, but to have TV camera crews following you around while you get ready for it.
You know, it was kind of a different time in my life. You know, I was, you know, my dad was my best friend, and he passed away just a little bit before then. And that's when I moved up to New York because, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And Bob and Arlene Santagato, you know, we came to an agreement that we'd partner our business together, and it was a great experience. But, you know, at that point in my life, you know, I was just missing my best friend, you know, I mean, and I miss him every day. And, you know, when I would go home from New York and I would see the farm and see how much it meant to me and how much I wanted to do something to protect it and eventually be able to pay it off. There was all these emotions running through, and the last cowboy and, you know, my best horse gonna trash the place got hurt, you know, and there I am searching for a horse, and it was surreal. And I think they really caught the realness of what we were going through. You know, to go back and watch it, it's, you know, you really enjoy it, but then you remember those, you know, what mental state you were into then. But it was awesome. I mean, Taylor's been amazing for our sport. And, you know, at that time, I'm glad that they were able to put what was going on in our life out there, because we're living that still. You know, I mean, we're at home now, we're back in Pennsylvania, and I'm loving it. And, you know, I'm paying that place off. And that's where that episode was on The Last Cowboy. And to be able to be on TV, and now I go to a golf course and people say, "Hey, are you the guy that was on the TV show?" And Fox News is coming out. Our local Fox News is doing a story on us because they watched The Last Cowboy. They're actually editing it right now. You know, it's kind of surreal. You never thought being a horse trainer, you'd be doing the things that you're doing now. But definitely one of the fun times in my life, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm glad that it inspired people out there, because that was just as real as it can get, what we were going through at that time in our life. So I'm glad to hear that. And I've heard a lot of that people really enjoyed it and enjoyed our story. So that means the world to me when you put yourself out there in front of the outside world, you know?
Yeah. So obviously Run for a Million, Last Cowboy, huge milestones. But so is crossing the $1 million threshold. So congratulations on that.
Let's talk a little bit
about that milestone, and like, what does that mean to you as a professional?
Oh man, you know, I mean, it just means the world, because, you know, I mean, I'll never forget my dad saying, "You're going to be a waste of talent, you know, if you don't do something about it." And you know, when I did that, because I didn't take it serious all those years, I had to catch up. I mean, right? I mean, I'm playing baseball in college, and Jordan's a little older than me, not much, and Jordan Larson's running for a limited open world title, and I'm playing baseball in college. And then all these other guys are coming in and they're horse training, they're working for people, they're going out on their own, and I'm still not taking this serious. So then when I actually finally took it serious, it was later, you know, I was 27, 28, and to be able to catch up the way I did. You know, people say, "Oh, you grew up, your show record's so long." Well, yeah, it's long, but half of it's youth career. You know, I wasn't showing for any money. And when I was a youth kid, it was kind of shunned upon to really show for any money. You know what I mean? So to be able to get to that point, to be able to cross that, and, you know, I did it on some lesser quality horses. You know, I mean, I wasn't rolling in it, you know, and now I am. And now I'm getting the quality horses. But a majority of that was, I was fortunate because those owners, that's what they could afford and that's what we could do. So, you know, and as a kid growing up, it was, you know, it was Sean Flair to Bill Horn and Rocky Dare were the $1 million riders I knew from, I call the East Coast. And, you know, to be in that category of guys that I idolized, I mean, it's just like a dream come true, you know, and I feel like you feel like you did something with your life, especially when you looked up to your father who said that. And said, "You're going to waste it if you don't do something for it." So it was a very emotional time when we crossed it because, you know, of course I miss them every day. And you know, I'll just never forget that. And that was a real driving force in me taking my career and my job a lot more serious.
honestly, I've always found your story inspiring, especially, you know, taking a break and finding yourself and then realizing that this is your dream. But talking to you today is just, it's so cool to hear your story and just how you're growing and having the ability to take a break at the fraternity and taking a step back and trying to reevaluate, you know, what is important to you and what you need to focus on and how you can improve on that. And like every piece of your story has been so cool to hear. What's the future like? What are you doing for the rest of the year besides going to horse shows probably from here on until the fraternity in December?
Yeah. I mean, it's a busy schedule. You know, I got, like I said, I got these three shows in the next 3 weeks and then next will be the 100X. Get ready for that. Then it's, you know, I got another show in Jersey, but then we have the Congress course. And then I got a couple shows in between the fraternity that I'll be going to. But you know, the biggest thing is doing my job, riding my horses, because that's number one, and doing what I love. But the next thing is keep pushing to get better. And I mean better all the way through. Better how you react to things when somebody says something that you might not agree with. How to deal with anything in life. You know, that's what pushes me now. You know, and that's what it's looking like for me in the future. You know, I got a lot of big dreams coming up ahead. I got a lot of good customers, great customers. I got a lot of good horses that I have right now. But you know, I think it's the biggest thing for me is enjoying the journey, because that journey was taken away last year and that sucked. And I'm just enjoying it right now. And I saw a lady that said, I'm 75 years today at the horse show. And I said, ma'am, you just keep on doing it. And I said, and don't worry about your score. Just beat yourself. If you marked a 65 the other day, mark a 65 and a half. And I said, and I think if that's where I'm going with my life, and that's the kind of thing that I'm going to push for people, is just get to be better every day. And I think if you take that approach, I swear to you guys, good things just keep coming your way. And that's how it's happened for me. And I just want to go and pass that along, because when I was kicked down, there was a lot of people that were there to pick me up. And I want to be that same kind of person for a lot of other people.
I love that so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate hearing that, especially from a trainer at your caliber who, you know, is at the top shows in the country around the top people. Like, I love hearing that. And I love the advice that you were talking to that woman. Just go out there and mark a 65 and a half the next time or whatever it is. And just keep getting better. I think
keep climbing the ladder, you know. Yeah. And she's going to get her 70 one day. And, you know, and that's going to mean the world to that woman. She doesn't have to go do the stuff that we're doing. But you know what? If you can just take a moment and say something to somebody that they might be a little like starstruck to say something to you, and just take your time out. Because I know when I was laying in that bed, I appreciated every single person that took 5 minutes out of their day to call me and check on me. And I swore to myself that I would try to be a better person, because I was lucky enough to have people that cared. So I think that's where I'm going with my career. You know, I'm going to achieve the thing, keep doing what I'm doing. But along that journey, I just want to keep on this track, because I feel like it's the right thing.
I mean, clearly this mindset's working. You've reached your $1 million crossing. You have had some great horse shows, great horses coming up for the fraternities. Like, it's so positive and inspiring. Where can people follow along this journey so that they can keep an eye on what you're doing? What's your social media?
Hop on Palmer Performance Horses Facebook page. Same thing on Instagram, on the IG, as the kids call it. You know, hop on there. You know, we have a really good social media team that's behind it. They do a lot of really neat stuff. I can take no credit for that at all. But when I do see it, when I'm laying in bed, they do a great job. And I know a lot of the people love it. You know, we get a lot of people writing in. You can hop on our Facebook page too, on our website. That's where they sell the hats and clothes and all that. We just started that, and that's been a really big hit. So check it all out. And reach out for anything anybody ever needs. We're here.
Awesome. Well, on that note, Matt, I know you're at a horse show, and I know you probably have a million and 10 things that you need to get doing. So with that, we will say thank you for coming on and talking with us.
It was my pleasure, guys. I really enjoyed it and look forward to the next time.
This episode of The Ride is brought to you by East of Wall. Thank you guys for tuning into the Ride Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and please be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow Horse and Rider Magazine on social media and find us at horseandrider.com to see all the cool things that we're up to. And if you have any comments or questions, please be sure to hit us up at horseandrider@equinenetwork.com. We want to hear from you guys. And if you like what you're listening to, please be sure to leave us a review on iTunes.